Tonight on Arena, Loa on getting back to the business of making music, and Sinead Gleeson and Anne-Marie Nicoran on the role of the artist in telling our history. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Loa, real name Sally Matthew Garnett, is best known for her unique blend of Afro folk soul music. Her body of work includes performances with both Hozier and Lisa Hannigan, as well as a feature role in Irish Women in Harmony. After returning to the front line to work as a pharmacist during the pandemic, she's had a very busy year. She co-hosted on the RTE show The Heart of Saturday Night with Una Healy, followed that up with a supporting role in the recent adaptation of Sally Rooney's Conversations with Friends, but she returns to her music roots this month with an appearance at the All Together Now Festival in County Waterford, and delighted to be joined by Loa on the programme this evening. It's certainly been a busy period of time for you, it has to be said, Loa. Let's talk a little bit about Conversations with Friends, the role you played as Evelyn. Now, there had been acting in the past before, for sure, but how did this particular role come about?
Yeah, well, just like anything else, Sean, if you stay persistent with something, you know, you find that things that you desired and prayed for years ago, you actually become ready for them and become skilled enough to bring them to pass. So I auditioned like everyone else, your bog standard self-tape, but it was a really beautiful role, Evelyn, because she's like a really gorgeous supporting character, and I got to sing in the show. So it really felt like the best way to start, you know, in a Lenny Abrahamson production, just kind of doing something so close to my heart.
The fact that Evelyn, was she always a singer? Because she has to sing a song in the midst of one of the episodes. Was that always there in the script, or was that something that developed as things went along?
I think that was something that I was very blessed enough to bring to the table. Evelyn does not sing a song in the novel, in Sally Rooney's novel. So I think Lenny was like, listen, sure you're here, you may as well. And I think that it's so Irish in that way that that's exactly what would be happening. A bunch of like arty people hanging out, like someone is going to break out a guitar, for better or for worse. And it just so happened that, you know, we were all there, and it's a beautiful Tim Buckley song. So it was just such a joy to get to offer that.
Let's have a little listen to a bit of that beautiful Tim Buckley song, as you say, Song to the Siren, and it is you performing here. I'm not sure if this is the exact soundtrack. I have a funny feeling that it has a lovely quality to it that perhaps it was done in studio, but let's have a listen. You can tell me afterwards.
Long afloat on shipless ocean, I did all my best to smile, till your singing eyes and fingers drew me loving to your isle, and you sang, sail to me, sail to me, let me unfold. Here I am, here I am, waiting to hold you.
So there we have the first verse of Tim Buckley's Song to the Siren, which is the song that Loa sang in Conversations with Friends. And my memory of that particular scene, Loa, is that it was much more impromptu. It was a kind of a, they're all sitting around after at a kind of post-dinner type of thing, and you break into song. That sounds beautifully polished. Did you make a recording of it, or how did it work?
Well, I'm glad you think it sounds polished, because we did do a recording of it afterwards in the studio. Someone asked me and said, would you not record that? That was really, really special. So we did. I didn't think of that, but someone made the suggestion, and we did it live in the studio, myself and Tyke. So it was about as rough as you can, as I would allow things to be in studio. Like, I would have loved to do a million takes, but I wanted to keep it as raw, as close to the original as possible. So it's just all one take. And yeah, it's really, it's such a haunting song.
That's your version of rough, is it?
Yeah. I suppose, yeah. I mean, I'm not exactly known for my being sloppy about things, but maybe too much sometimes. Yeah. We'll see. I guess it's arguable.
Yeah, but talk to me a little bit more about the acting side of things, because you said that, you know, if you persist long enough, if you keep knocking on the doors, you know, if there's something that you've always wanted to do, that you just might be lucky enough to make it happen. Was acting a long-term ambition?
Yes, it has been. I think I've always wanted to do it, and like I got the lead role in the school musical in Maynooth Post Primary as Miss Adelaide in Guys and Dolls, and I got a taste for it, and I knew that I loved it, and I've always, like, people around me are always like, "Oh my God, you know you're so good at acting, you should do acting just because I can do a good Australian accent or whatever." But aside from the kind of jovial side, I actually love getting really into a character and just being able to express that part of your imagination. But I kind of put it on the back burner because, you know yourself, music is very all consuming. But it was my music coach, my vocal coach, Judith Mock, that said to me, you know, there's this place in Dublin 7 called Bow Street School, and I think you should just go and do a little course in there. And they do screen acting. And I did. I took her advice and I went in the middle of doing, like, getting on with gigging and making records. And it kind of took me on a little bit of a side journey where I almost immediately started getting work. And then I kept at it and I got an agent in London. And during the pandemic, I remember I was doing a lot of tapes and I was kind of going, you know what, maybe this was a nice, I had beginner's luck, but maybe I should just, like, pack this in. You know, everything is so hard. But I kept doing tapes, and I actually made this kind of internal promise to myself. I was like, if I don't get anything by Christmas 2020, I'm out of the game. And this is a really interesting lesson in intention, because maybe by saying that to myself, I detached from the outcome. Right. And I'm not joking you, in early December of 2020, I got cast in Kin.
Yes.
The Irish, crime drama. And I was like, okay, I get the joke. You know, you have to stay with it. Like, I'm with 2 weeks to go to my own deadline. And I was about to, like, leave my agent and do all of that. And then a couple of months later, I got conversations with friends. And I was like, okay, if you keep knocking, things come through.
Well, if you have the talent, things come through, perhaps. And yeah, I know there's a bit of luck and all of that involved. But it kind of, you played a bit of reverse psychology on the universe. That's what that sounds like to me. Of course, you had been to Trinity yourself. I mentioned we spoke about this the last time you were on with me, if I remember right, about going back into work as a pharmacist during the pandemic, because you had studied pharmacy. But you'd studied in Trinity. So I suppose the world of Sally Rooney's books, you were familiar with it at least.
Oh, totally. When I read her books, it was like reading my own journals and my friends' journals from the time. I was like, I hooked, like many people. I read them in one sitting or two sittings, you know. And I think she really tapped into something really, like, interesting about the Trinity, because it is this really, you know, kind of prestigious university, and you have to work hard to get the points and all of that, and you're surrounded by, like, really intelligent people, but they're just kids, you know. At the end of the day, like, the brains might be there, the studies might be behind them, but everyone's just figuring it out like kids anywhere in the world. And it was just that I love that juxtaposition of them just having a really hard time in their relationships, but being really able to argue and be really clever. And it's so gripping. So I felt like I was playing the older version of myself and looking at Sacha Lane and Alison Oliver acting. It really reminded me of my time there and hanging out with my friends.
Did you insist that your scenes would be in Croatia as well, that you'd have to struggle through that beautiful country
for
a while?
That was so hard. Yeah, really hard. It was a stipulation of my contract. No, that was pure and utter jamminess. Now, I have to say, they're not all like that.
No, that's for sure. And I'm sure, despite the fact that it wasn't a lovely location, you were working while you were there. Let us not forget that. Your EP of poems from the 1920s set to music. Tell me a little bit. You have a new vinyl release with the track "When I Rise Up." Why vinyl, and why that particular track? I know it's seminal to the EP anyway.
Yeah. No, so the vinyl is actually the whole EP. It's all of it, all seven songs. And,
all right.
But it's named, the whole record is named after that one track, because I feel like that's very much the title, the titular track, you know,
yeah.
When I Rise Up. It kind of summarizes the whole project. So yeah, it's a two-side vinyl. About half an hour, and it was one of those things where it arose naturally, because that music, you know, those poems, they're from the time of early recording, where vinyl was just coming into being, and like the jazz scene was exploding. So it felt really wrong not to have them all digital only, and even the way we recorded them was kind of live and acoustic. So Digger's Factory, it was a really cool project. They approached me and they said, "Look, we do this thing, we will promise to make your vinyl if you can get X amount of people to pre-order it." So it's a kind of a really nice, vulnerable way of doing vinyl if you're independent, where you don't have to shell out like loads and have like stacks of vinyl in your gaff, in your shed. You know, they go, we'll take this care of the printing if you just tell your people to pre-order it. And when we hit the minimum amount, we'll print it and send it to them.
Okay.
So that's kind of the project. Yeah. And it's a really beautiful modern way of doing it, I think.
So what did you do? Did you say, if I haven't got X number of orders by the end of January 2021, I'm not going to do it? Or how did that work?
Pretty much, that's kind of seems to be working for me. So we launched it a couple of weeks ago, so I'm kind of going, okay, let's go with my birthday, October, let's say by October.
So you did put a kind of a date on yourself. Just remind us of the whose words you're singing. We listened to a little bit of the titular track, as you say, Loa, When I Rise Up. Remind us whose words you're singing here.
Georgia Douglas Johnson. She is a Harlem Renaissance poet and a great mind from the time of the 20s and the Harlem Renaissance in, you know, black rights, civil rights, women's rights. She was all encompassing, amazing woman. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's listen to a little bit then of When I Rise Up.
When I rise up above the earth and look down on the things that fetter me, when I rise up above the earth and look down on the things that fetter me, I beat my wings upon the air. I beat my wings upon the air. I beat my wings upon the air, or tranquilize. Surge after surge of potent strength, like incense, comes to me. Surge after surge of potent strength, like incense, comes to me. When I rise up above the earth, when I rise up above the earth, look down upon the things that fetter me. Look down upon the things that fetter me.
And there we have a part of When I Rise Up from Loa. That's the new vinyl version. Was it just a repress, or do you go back in and kind of rework things, given what you were saying to me about your desire to, you know, to always be tinkering with stuff in the studio, Loa?
Yeah, I know that, you know, I'm really glad you asked that, because I did have this whole quandary, because the character that I am, I would want to go in and like remix the whole thing and everything and do like 10 versions, alternate takes. But the guy who mixed it, he did an amazing job at the time, and he kind of explained the technicality of it. And he was like, listen, this is really good for vinyl. We already made it sound like that. So just trust it, you know, trust the record. It's fine. It's good. And I trust him.
Open to the
advice of others.
Yeah,
as well.
And good to trust him, because it sounds lovely, I must say, on the basis of what I heard.
Thank
there. I mentioned to you, I mentioned this idea of the it's women's poetry that you and women's writings that you have put to music on the EP. And later in the program, I'm going to be speaking with Sinead Gleeson and Anne-Marie Nicoran about a discussion at the Errigal Arts Festival, Women and the State, Writing Irish History. They're looking at this, you know, what artists can do, perhaps, that the history writers or even the politicians can't do. The artist has a different role. Talk to me a little bit about Georgia Douglas Johnson and why you wanted to highlight her words.
Yeah, well, she's amazing because I'm so glad you asked. She used to have these salons, right? So she was, the Harlem Renaissance largely happened in Harlem, New York, but she was based further south in Washington, D.C. And but she used to have these salons in her living room where all the intelligentsia of the time, when they were touring their books or their poetry books or going on speaking tours, she'd have them all come to her place and drink tea. So she was like the hostess with literally the most desk, because she was also a huge intellect and a really amazing, prolific writer. So she had all Langston Hughes and everyone come and hang out, and they talk about their work, talk about what was happening. And what's amazing is that, you know, like with any artistic community, those conversations are what breed the next round of writings. So people go away and they have arguments and they get competitive and then they agree and they have, you know, these really exciting nights that used to go on into the night. And then she'd sit, when everyone was left and the house was tidy and clean and quiet again, she'd write more and everyone go off on their tours and write. So I feel like she was both at the center of it as a person, as a warm kind of wonderful hostess, you know, that very feminine nurturing quality of comfort tea, and also a really bold intellect who was at the center of the writings. So I just thought that was amazing.
And I saw the most beautiful video today, which you've also released. Is this Georgia Douglas Johnson as well? Are these her words in your world?
Yes, they are. So I took one thing of artistic license where I basically cheated. So the EP is largely from the 1920s. However, Your World is further on. It's her work, but it's about 30, 40 years on. And that was my one kind of like, well, I'm allowed to do this because there's no rules, right? And it's called Your World. And it's almost like her at towards the end of her life, looking back on all of this that she's gone through and just going, your world is as big as you make it. Like, well,
you
that's
know, you're saying that it was a little bit later than the 1920s, the 30s or the 40s. But when I was listening to this, these are words for 2020. You know, what year are we in? 2022. I want to play this and I want to listen to it with you, because I just think the words and the video for it is absolutely beautiful. So let's have a listen to your version of Your World.
As big as you make it, I know, for I used to abide in the narrowest nest in a corner, my wings pressing close to my side. But I sighted the distant horizon, where the skyline encircled the sea, and I throbbed with a burning desire to travel this immensity. I battered the cordons around me and cradled my wings on the breeze, then soared to the most reaches with rapture, with power, with ease. Your world is as big as you make it. I know, for I used to abide in a corner, my wings pressing close to my side. But I sighted the distant horizon, where the skyline encircled the sea, and I throbbed with a burning desire to travel this immensity. Soar to the uttermost reaches
That's Your World from Loa, the words of Georgia Douglas Johnson. And I urge you to go on YouTube and find the video for that. Loa, it's all that opening sentence, Your World is as big as you make it. I mean, it really struck me. You're hitting on diversity across this video in the most beautiful way. And the lyrics really do sound like the lyrics of today to me. I presume that was what attracted you to it.
Absolutely. I felt like there's such generosity of spirit in those lyrics and openness that is so human that I felt like she was just speaking directly to me. And on the EP, I also did one. I did WB Yeats. I did, like, you know, his great The Second Coming, because it was like the big apocalypse poem, and it's 100 years on in, you know, from 1920. But and that's that he I remember reading about how he spoke about why he wrote that poem the way he did. And he said, I might be speaking to this moment, but I know that humans go in cycles, and 100 years from now, I want people to read it and feel something similar, because they might well need to read it then. And I was like, oh my God, like, what prescience, like, he's right, you know. So I feel like I'm always attracted to those when artists get right down to the root of it and speak from there.
Well, listen, it's great to speak with you this evening. I'm sure you're looking forward to All Together Now, and I'm sure people will be hearing lots of songs from the EPs and et cetera, when you're there. Lovely to have spoken with you, Loa. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Sean, for having me on. Take care.
That's Loa. When I Rise Up, the EP will be released on vinyl in October. Loa will be performing at All Together Now, which takes place from July the 29th through until the 31st. And also, please go and look up that video. It's absolutely gorgeous. You'll find out all of the details of her upcoming performance at alltogethernow.ie, and find out more about her music and probably that video too on loamusic.com. Over the past couple of weeks, we've brought you musicians and filmmakers who are appearing at this year's Errigal Arts Festival in Donegal. Tonight, it's the turn of a pair of writers taking part in a fascinating panel discussion that combines the political and the artistic this Sunday at Rathmullen House. Sinead Gleeson chairs the event, Women and the State, Writing Irish History. Panel of three writers, poet Anne-Marie Nicoroin, journalist Aoife Moore and poet and novelist Elaine Feeney will be on that panel. Sunday's bill is music from also features music from Breege Harper, the fiddler player you may have heard on Arena last Tuesday. But delighted that Sinead Gleeson and Anne-Marie Nicoran join me on the programme this evening. I suppose, Sinead, no better person to be chairing a discussion like this, given your two short story anthologies, The Long Gaze Back and The Glass Shore, that were all about female writers, both famous and those who've been kind of pushed to the one side. Also in your own collection of essays, Constellations 2. I suppose everyone on the panel that you have at this event has real experience in reclaiming lost voices and view. Just to maybe explain to us what the remit of Women and the State, this panel discussion, is. Give us the context.
Well, I think it's very much about, Sean, the idea about what it means to bear witness in literature to histories of the Irish state, and then how we bear witness to the lives of vulnerable women and families, and how we basically tell stories through poetry or filmmaking or visual art, how we incorporate very difficult, very totemic, very events that often have a lot of longevity, that linger for a long time, how artists and writers and journalists then transform them into, without, you know, treading on, you know, there'll be a lot of talk about, we've had a lot of literature and documentation around reports and stuff, but how do we make them into something artistic? How do we make it to something that is outside of the kind of ideological and government aspect of things? How do we make them into poems or stories, into novels? How do we do that? And I think a lot of what we're going to get into talking about will actually try and attempt to get around that.
Well, Anne-Marie is with us on the phone. Anne-Marie Nicoran is with us on the phone as well. And who better to ask about how you take material, historical documents, Anne-Marie, and turn it into art or use it as a springboard for art? Because that's precisely what you did in your recent collection, The Poison Glen.
Good evening, Sean. Yes, I suppose I've had a long interest in the subject of women's lives under the founding of the Irish state. And, you know, it probably began with the story of my grandmother who gave birth in a mother and baby home. And so that theme of family separation and what happened to women under the founding of the state runs through both of my books, Bloodroot and The Poison Glen. And I suppose it's, you know, an area I'm really interested in. How do you take difficult, sensitive material and how do you transform it? And how do you give something back to the world that is mysterious? And with that kind of working with these kind of heavy historical subjects, there comes so much responsibility, I suppose. And I'm hoping that we'll get into the discussion of like, what are the challenges and what are the responsibilities of the writer when writing Irish history?
Yeah, it did strike me, Sinead, and Anne-Marie has touched on it there. When you are taking difficult and sensitive material and very private material, or some people may want the material to remain very private, art is, I suppose, there's more to it than entertainment. I accept that, but there is that entertainment aspect to it. It's a very fine line that you need to thread in that transfer from historical fact to artistic entertainment or artistic engagement.
Yeah, because there are challenges with trying to transform difficult subjects, like whether you take mother and baby homes or the laundries or, you know, institutional abuse or, you know, the church or whatever the things are. There's a lot of responsibility comes with that, and also the idea of, you know, who are you being faithful to? Who gets to tell the story? And again, I know you mentioned like the anthologies at the start of the show, and that a lot of the reasons that those books exist is the idea that lots of women's voices got silenced from the Irish canon, and that's just in literature. And all the way along, we're already used to the idea that lots of women don't get to have traditionally, historically, and again, this is very much tied into the 100 years idea, the centenary. We've had a lot of commemorations in the last few years that there can be a danger of nostalgifying and you know, looking back to the past when lots of the things I hope we're going to get into talking about on Sunday is the fact that so lots of things have changed. Not enough things have changed, but even the things that have changed need more new direction and more engagement. So the problem as well, if you're trying to, you know, be artistic, whether that's making films or writing poetry or whatever it is about difficult subjects, is that you don't want to go down the road of polemic. If polemic can be like a you know, I always say to students in class, like a rant is boring. So to bring in like big institutional satanic information without kind of overloading people with information and while making it crafted and making it lyrical and making it poetic and making it a piece of art. So those things are, it's a very difficult juxtaposition and it can be very hard to do, I think. But I think the people, I mean, in terms of Anne-Marie's work and Elaine Feeney's work, I absolutely believe they do that. And Aoife Maurer does that in a different way in her journalism. So we'll definitely dive into all those things when we have our conversation.
Yeah, and Anne-Marie, I suppose that there is that added layer when I'm talking about taking the material of sensitive material, other people's stories. You were doing this in and around your own family. Did that add a layer of difficulty? Did you speak to your family about what you might do there? Or was it easier to approach it when you felt closer to it? You felt perhaps you had some ownership over the story?
I think having a personal connection to the mother and baby homes history did give me a way of connecting in, and it gave me kind of a doorway into that history. But absolutely, I think, you know, in terms of my own writing, I'm always thinking that this is a living story. You know, it draws upon facts from my own life. It draws upon facts from the life of my family and many survivors who are going to read the book and are going to read the poem. And I always think I want to make a thing of beauty and resonance, but I want to also make a thing that does no harm. And that's the ultimate challenge. And I think, you know, this kind of work in poetry demands a long, deep, careful engagement. And, you know, many of the writers that I look to who have written on this subject, is almost a lifetime's work for them. So it's certainly not, you know, material. Yeah. It's not the Poison Glen wasn't written in a year or even 2 years, but it's a kind of a culmination of self-reflection and conversation with family and conversation with community.
Well, let's hear something from The Poison Glen then. You have the poem Sow Thistle. Is it Sow Thistle or Soul Thistle? I meant to check this with you beforehand. Say again, sorry.
Well, I say so. I say sow thistle, so that might be right or wrong, but
well,
I say sow thistle.
It's your poem, so I'd say sow thistle too. Do you need to give us a context here, or will you just read it for us, Anne-Marie?
It's a poem that was written in response to St. Joseph's Industrial School in Dundalk, County Louth, which was run by the Sisters of Mercy up until the 1980s. And in fact, the whole book, The Poison Glen, features a number of responses to different institutions all throughout Ireland. So this is titled Sow Thistle. Here in the aftermath of the orphanage, I watched the local schoolgirls gathering along the street's chipped black railings, and two by two link slender arms to troop uptown against the sun, all high heads and clear temples, all grit and burning, all clean hair flashing ponies. Who knows the earth more than a girl? Who knows the auguries of stone? We were often told, you are the lowest of the low. We cupped our hands to the grass to see how low. What cannot be written is rising up through the cracks. I kneel to a sow thistle, leaf starred and gold between my fingers, the stalk throbbing light. I encounter its living testimony as closely as I would encounter the expert findings of any state report.
Anne-Marie Nicora in there reading her poem Sow Thistle, and that's part of Anne-Marie's collection, recent collection, The Poison Glen, published by the Gallery Press just last year. In fact, I remember we spoke about it at the time. Anne-Marie, with me this evening is Anne-Marie Nicora and Sinead Gleeson. They're part of a panel discussion at this year's Errigal Arts Festival around women and the state. Sinead, Anne-Marie said something that really caught my ear when she was talking just before that poem about this idea that she wanted to write something that would do no harm. But I guess what you're also talking about in the case of an artist responding to our history, yes, you don't want to do harm, but you do want it, I presume, to have some kind of effect, maybe to do some good. Who are the artists that you're looking at who you feel have managed that particular act of doing good or having an effect, their work has had an effect?
Well, I think so many, and I feel like I need to very much start with the fact that New Ireland Books are about to reissue Almost There, which is a sequel to Neil O'Fallon's incredible book, Are You Somebody? And I think that a lot of, I mean, I was asked an awful lot, as I know Emily Pine was, about the essay in Ireland and, you know, the idea that all of a sudden people seem to find their voice in nonfiction. And I think for a long time there was a lot of silences, a lot of things that women didn't speak about, you know, whether in Nuala's book it was, you know, alcoholism and promiscuity and maybe being, you know, bisexual or whatever it was, but also the poverty in Irish households, the silences, the violence, the neglect, the emotional neglect. And I think that a lot of what went on with that book, I think, started a huge conversation about saying the unsayable and breaking down the silences. And that's what we've been dealing with for the last 20 years. And maybe if we're going back 100 years with the timeline of this event, is that the things have gotten in some ways easier to say for some people. It's easier to have these kind of conversations. So for me, I would have said, like Neil O'Fallon's book, I also think Rosalind McDonough's incredible memoir, Unsettled, which is about not just her experience as a traveller woman, but as a disabled woman, but also in these institutions that we will be talking about a lot, these institutions that end up being neglectful, where abuse happens, where terrible things and terrible stories happen. Elaine Feeney is on our panel as well, and her poetry collection Rise features an amazing poem called History Lesson about domestic violence, which I know that Aoife Moore Gracie, who is our other panelist, has talked about, that she thinks one of the big issues with Troubles, and Aoife is obviously a journalist from Derry, and she thinks that, you know, the unspoken story of the Troubles is domestic violence about women. Mm. So all of these, for me, it's, those three books are very kind of are very in conversation with each other. But there's so many books and art, and I think Anne-Marie would have many more to say as well.
Yeah, I'll come back to Anne-Marie on the specifics of who you might suggest we could read, Anne-Marie, but I wanted to touch on something in the poem that it struck me that you read for us, Sow Thistle, and I wondered what poetry allows you to say and to do that perhaps if you were writing pure facts down on the page, you know, or transmitting facts down onto the page, it might be rather different. It is that we hear that description of the schoolgirls at the top in the first part of the poem, and then suddenly you kneel to a sow thistle, and we're brought into a different world, a metaphorical world, a poetic world. Does poetry give you something? Can you say things there that you simply couldn't say if you were writing non-fiction?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, the art, the poetry allows us to ask the questions that sometimes society will not. And for me, the poem is this honest thing, you know, and it is free of agenda. It's, you know, it's an act of surprise or transformation. And it kind of, you know, it allows me to say things that I can't say outside the poem. I think my whole first book, Bloodroot, was really a kind of, you know, trying to wrestle with family history and ancestry and family loss, and the book was a place that I could explore questions that you know, I couldn't do outside of the book. And I think it's, you know, it's lovely that this event on Sunday is happening in Donegal as well, because I think there's such a natural cultural sensitivity in Donegal for the different ways that history gets recorded outside of government reports. You know, we have a wonderful culture of recording stories and folklore in myth, in ritual. And then, you know, we have this, the Irish language as well in Northwest Donegal. Yeah. And I feel it's really important that this event is happening in proximity to the Gaelic, because that's a language that predates and survives a lot of the traumas that we'll be covering on Sunday.
And Anne-Marie, just you've also, I think you're beginning to look at, into the history of the Stranorlar Workhouse as part of a new artist in residence job that you're doing with Donegal County Council. Do you look at all the factual material first and then kind of put it to the one side and then try to have some kind of artistic response to it? Is that how it works for you?
It's usually a kind of a three-part phase. I normally try and visit a site, first of all. So I'll be visiting the site of Stranorlar Workhouse, and I'll be thinking about the closure of that workhouse and how it transitioned into the county home, which was where a lot of unmarried mothers and children were in residence at the start of, you know, around 1923. So I suppose my process is that I go and visit the site and I write intuitively, first of all. And then I come back to the desk and I do the research, or I visit the archives and I look at all the materials. And then the kind of third part as well, the alchemy happens. You know, I put together kind of my own feelings and intuition on it with the actual facts and data.
You have to let the magic do its work. And I know, just I will come back to you just briefly, Sinead, in a minute, but I know Republic of Shame, Stories from Ireland's Institution for Fallen Women, this is Kayleen Hogan's book, and Kimberly Campanello's long poem Mother Baby Home. I watched part of that poem online today. It's very powerful stuff, Anne-Marie.
Yeah, and I'd also recommend Little Witness by Connie Roberts. She's a survivor of one of the institutions, and also Vacant Possession by Anne Fitzgerald with Salmon Press as well. So those four books are a good starting point, along with the books that Sinead mentioned and the author she mentioned there as well.
So Sinead, that mix of art and history will lead to a very potent discussion, I would have thought, on Sunday.
Yeah, I hope so, and I hope that I realise that a lot of what we're talking about tonight is quite difficult and quite heavy, but I hope to end the discussion by talking about, you know, where we go in the future. Because so I say to people all the time, especially when I do events outside of Ireland, that I think Ireland has changed more in the last 10 years than it has in the previous 60. So I think there's a lot of scope for positivity. There's a whole new generation now who are much more interested in activism, are very vocal, who want to see change, and I think I just think there's a lot of positivity to be had in terms of, like, so the conversations that we can have around these subjects are meaning that not only when we talk about them and get them out in the open and get away from that silence, but also talk about change, how can actually affect real change, whether that's around, you know, putting people into, like, you know, getting more women in government, getting people on more school bodies, you know, all of these things are all, it's an ongoing thing, it's an ongoing process, and I think that's what we'll definitely
And one other thing I wanted to touch on, because I think this fits into Elaine Feeney being part of your panel as well on Sunday, Sinead, is Anne-Marie was talking about the different ways in which, and in fact she mentioned the Irish language, but Elaine is specifically looking at oral histories, or has been looking, she's part of an oral histories project as well, isn't she?
Elaine has done incredible work and voluntary work as part of the two oral histories, and she's basically collated and talked to loads of survivors about their experience. And again, those things, especially people who don't feel they're artists or writers who have the language or have the permission to
tell their stories, can talk to people like Elaine and other writers who will facilitate and help them tell these very painful, very difficult stories. And again, all of this stuff can always be changed in the future if people keep telling the terrible things that happened in the past and never being pushed into corners of silence and reminding people it's not that long ago, as loads of things we know about in terms of repeal and, you know, the 1983 Act. As long as we keep talking and telling these stories, there will always be pockets of light and there will always be people ready to hand the baton on against this younger generation. So I think it's really important.
Anne-Marie, on Changa Lauerha, on Wilshishin, Tawaktuk, Igos, on Star, Idunagal, that spoken language and that oral history, is that important in terms of the history of Donegal?
Oh, yeah. I mean, on the Tawakta, I guess are in Dona Fasta and Changa, I guess, Lord Free, I guess, Igarker and Severus, I guess, and Belligis, I guess, and Star, at a bunch of Lish and Changa. I mean, it's really important that we acknowledge the Irish language, which is the Irish of, you know, the language of our foremothers and is, you know, the language in which, you know, a lot of trauma happened. And it's lovely to be rerouting now back in the West this conversation. And having this conversation where so much of that kind of pre-colonial stuff, richness is still kind of alive. So
and thanks very much also to Sinead Gleeson for being with us this evening. Women and the State, Writing Irish History, that event takes place at Rathmullen House in County Donegal, 3 p.m. on Sunday the 24th of July. It's part of the Errigal Arts Festival and the website is eafarrigalartsfestival.ie. A fast pyre of screens, metal and plants sits in the basement gallery space of the Fairgreen building in Galway. The structure emits white noise, industrial clatter and interference, while screens show messages and maps. This is Entanglement, the work of Annex, a collaboration between artists, architects and researchers who curated the work at the Irish Pavilion in the Venice Architecture Biennale last year. Entanglement, it attempts to physicalise the cloud and ask those who walk around it and sit before it to consider the environmental impact of interacting with the internet, even in a small way, like sending an email or posting on social media. Sinead Egan went along to see Entanglement and she spoke to some of the architects and researchers behind the project.
Yes, my name is David Capener. I'm an architect, designer, and a researcher, and one of the six-person team that's called Annex that curated Entanglement at the Venice Architecture Biennale, that then showed in Berlin at Transmedia and is now here in Galway.
And this structure, we're on radio now, so this is going to be tricky, but can you describe it for me?
It's noisy, it's loud, it's messy, it's dirty, it's burnt, it feels angry, and it's that for a reason. The piece we built, in a nutshell, is the cloud. It's all the processes that are often hidden behind those split-second moments when we send a text or a Facebook message or a tweet, and the hidden processes behind this kind of strange ethereal metaphor of the cloud, which feels clean and feels nice and feels fluffy. But the reality is behind that, there are a multiplicity of different processes that are often hidden, but are having extraordinary implications on energy consumption, particularly here on the island of Ireland, but also kind of many other processes and effects on everyday life and how we live.
Just going back to the structure itself, which is so striking, one gets the sense that it's alive. Was that a goal when you were putting this thing together?
Absolutely. It was a conversation we had as a team very early on. It took us a while to work through that as artists. We wanted the piece to be performative. We wanted it to confront you in a bodily way. I mean, you've been down with the piece. It's very noisy. You can feel the sound resonating within you. So we really wanted to position the viewer in the story of the cloud, of the materiality of the cloud, of this sort of dirty, noisy beast that exists in elsewhere places that otherwise we wouldn't see. We wanted to foreground that and say, this is the cloud, this is what happens when you engage in these seemingly innocuous, simple processes.
The 12 seats that surround the structure downstairs, for the people who sit in them and look at it for a period of time, what impression do you want them to get? How do you want them to feel?
We want them to feel what it is like when we engage in these processes in which everyday life is increasingly becoming entangled. Whether that is someone who encounters the work for 30 seconds. And we've seen that regularly. People come in, they can't handle the noise, they can't handle the intensity of the experience, and they walk straight out. And we see people engage with the structure for an hour. And both of those experiences are really valid. So we want people to encounter it, to enjoy it. It's a piece to enjoy, but also a piece to foreground some of these conversations that we feel should be happening even more than they are right now.
My name is Fiona McDermott. I'm one of the curators of the Entanglement exhibition, and I'm a researcher at Trinity College Dublin. So the bonfire symbol is very important in a way, because we're trying to draw an analogy between maybe how you think people innately are drawn towards heat and fire, if you think in terms of traditional society. And in a way, we're making an analogy with how we're drawn into the internet now, and how we form new societies and communities around that. And, you know, both are driven by a kind of human desire, and you're embroiled in it. When we were putting together the proposal, I was also devising a summer school that was going to be situated at Valentia Island. So I was doing a lot of reading and research around the history there. And it just seemed that while these technologies are always framed as kind of being new and, you know, almost without a history or ahistorical, that a lot of the stories that we wanted to tell about contemporary data infrastructure in Ireland had kind of pre-existed, or there was a memory of it within the story of the transatlantic telegraph cable.
My name is Donal Lally, and I'm an architect, a practicing architect and researcher. And over the last few years, from about 2015, I've been looking at data centres in Ireland quite specifically. And my interest initially started with just sort of these anonymous boxes that started to appear over the last 10 years in the kind of exurbs around Dublin. And then my interest kind of sort of deepened into the kind of ecologies that these data centres were forming in these urban kind of matrices in which they were settled. So the idea that the data centre is some sort of like anonymous box with computers and somehow divorced from everything around it was a common perception of how these things operated. But actually what we were seeing was these kind of new forms, new relationships. So for instance, Amazon and Tala are plugging their data centre, their fifth data centre, into a district heating system. And that district heating system is going to heat TU Dublin, or TU Dublin Tala campus, Tala Hospital, about 1,600 apartments, Rua Red Gallery, and many other buildings. So the actual heat being produced by these data centres has now been recycled into our cities. So the act of consuming content online is producing heat inside these server halls, and that heat's been recycled into, say, a hospital ward. So these kind of whole new ecologies of our relationship to screens and the processing that goes on behind those screens, if you will, and how they are impacting our cities, I found really fascinating.
So could I say then that your philosophy towards, or your attitude towards data centers isn't entirely negative in that sense?
Well, it's like any technology, there's good and bad. For instance, if you're recycling heat that's wasted, that's kind of interesting, and I think that's useful. But if that heat has been produced in dirty means, then that's a problem. So at the moment, Ireland, you know, give or take a kind of windy day or whatever, we have 40 to 60% of all energy is produced by fossil fuels. So these data centres don't have a different energy mix to everybody else. They're using fossil fuels predominantly to fuel the data economy. And again, we're having a lot of discourse about this in the public press at the moment. But if the electricity that goes into these data centres is dirty, then the heat that's been recycled is also dirty. And for me, there's big questions about, like, if we're allowing our cities to be plugged into private companies in this way, what kind of new, how do they need us and how do we need them going into the future? What kind of relationship between public and private are we sort of investing in here? It becomes quite tricky, I think. So the technology is just technology. I think it's a given that we're migrating online more and more every year. And there's big benefits to that. We've seen the positives and the negatives through the pandemic of actually being able to contact and communicate across the internet. But also the internet itself, the weight of the internet, the data centers, the cables, the energy systems that are supporting it are having profound consequences on our landscapes. And I'm not... One of the original projects that really interested us was the Transatlantic Telegraph Cable, 1858, that connected the new world of, you know, the United States of America to the British Empire. The first form of instant messaging, celebrated as a form of magic. It was a technological feat, the equivalent of the moon landing in the 19th century. But that cable, it was about 3,000 kilometres long, and there was many failed attempts as well to land. But that cable was insulated with something called Palladium gutta percha, which is a latex that was harvested from a tree that was found in Southeast Asia. That tree, over about between 1858 and 1910, was harvested to produce many cables linking Europe and America and then beyond. And about 70 million trees were harvested. The tree, we tried to source the tree for the exhibition in Venice, and it's still on the endangered list. So, and the real tragedy there as well is that when these forests were cleared, they became what are now the palm oil plantations. So in the 19th century, the first act of creating this kind of new form of magic technology that was weightless, it was Morse code, it was just code that was floating in the air, was having profound ecological consequences somewhere far away. And we found that story from 150 years ago to be a really useful way of thinking about the cloud today, because it's the same story. It's still sold to us like a magic space in which we can kind of distribute information, and it's not having any kind of effect. It doesn't have any weight. But actually, in Ireland specifically, we can see the weight all around us, but we just need to look at it as well. So there's a lot there, yeah. You know. Yeah. But that would be some of the things that I'd be thinking about.
Architect Don Lally there of Annex, finishing that package from Sinead Egan. And Entanglement is at the Fir Green Gallery in Galway through until the 24th of July as part of the Galway International Arts Festival, GIAF.ie, for full details on that one. Tomorrow evening on the programme, we will be speaking to Anthony and Joe, my best friends, the Russo brothers. They'll be telling us all about their new feature film, The Grey Man, which stars, among others, Ryan Gosling, Chris Evans and Ana de Armas. Looking forward to that enormously. And we'll also be speaking about the Happy Days Enniskillen International Beckett Festival with some of those who have the task of performing the enigmatic playwright's work. That is on tomorrow night's Arena here on RTÉ Radio 1. But that is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Cara O'Hare was on sound this evening. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you once again 7 o'clock tomorrow night here on RTÉ Radio 1. And John Creedon will be with you straight after the 8 o'clock news.